Well, Nehemiah is a book about rebuilding. It's about a book about rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem, but it's also about rebuilding the people as well. And in this chapter, we come face to face with how God called Nehemiah to this work. So you could call this message "When God Calls," or you could call it "Preparing to Rebuild." In the summer, the news finally broke. Manchester United appointed Erik ten Hag to be their coach. It was the worst kept secret of many a year. And one thing that was confirmed as soon as he was appointed was that this is going to be a massive rebuilding job. Old Trafford itself, the ground wasn't falling down, but the team were falling apart and they needed to be rebuilt. And that rebuilding work is still going on. We'll see how it works out as the season goes on. Who is Ten Hag, people were saying? Who is this manager from Holland? We don't know anything about him. Well, people know a little bit more about him now. Well, who is Nehemiah? Who is Nehemiah? And why does God call him to rebuild Jerusalem? Well, look at the setting. The setting is in the month of Kislev, in the 20th year, while I was in the citadel of Susa, Hanani, one of my brothers, came from Judah with some other men. I questioned them about the Jewish remnant that had survived the exile and also about Jerusalem. What was this month of Kislev? Or Chislev, however you want to call it. Well, it was about November or December, our November or December, so getting up to this time now. During the 20th year of who or what? Well, it's the reign of King Artaxerxes. And it's interesting, if that's the 20th year, we can date it very, very precisely. Got a picture here, I think, in the next slide, if we can get it. There we are, the 20th year. And if you can just make out, the citadel of Susa is mentioned. Now, that was the king's winter palace, set in modern-day Iran. And you've got a picture there of the whole Persian Empire in green, stretching far and wide, massive, massive empire. And then he asks about the Jewish remnant that had survived the exile. Who were they? Well, they're the ones who have returned after being in exile in Babylon all this time. They have returned. And it was about 83 years earlier than this that they'd all gone back because King Cyrus had said they could go, they could return. So for some reason, we don't know why, Nehemiah is still there. He's still in the kingdom of Persia, serving. He hasn't gone back, but he's asking about how they're doing. How are they? So what have we got to learn, perhaps, from these opening verses? Well, first of all, I think we can learn about a burden. A burden. That's the next point. Notice what it said. They said to me, those who survived the exile are back in the province. They're in great trouble. They're in great trouble. They're in disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down. Its gates have been burned with fire. When I heard these things, I sat down and wept. Now, what would it take for you to sit down and weep this morning? Well, something or someone very dear to you. Something bad has happened. You would weep. Something you care about deeply would cause you to weep. Now, is Nehemiah just being kind of sentimental here? Is he being just a bit patriotic? You think of the people, we've had We've had people in our church who've come from Ukraine, Ukrainian refugees, and they're seeing the news, and they're seeing fresh bombings of their cities, and I'm sure they are tempted to weep about that, because they're patriotic about their country. Is that what this is? Or is it just that with Nehemiah? He's weeping? I think it's more than that. He says, I mourned and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. Why would he do that? Well, because this city of Jerusalem is not only bound up with the nation, but it's bound up with God, with God's name. It's bound up with the name of the Lord. The city the Lord had chosen out of all the tribes of Israel in which to put his name, 1 Kings 14 says. So God's reputation is bound up with this city. And it bothers Nehemiah that it's in such disrepair. It bothers him that it's in trouble and disgrace. Not only the city and his countrymen, but God's name. God's name is being disgraced. So when God begins a work in a people or in a church, that work of rebuilding will start with a burden, with a concern. In 1857 in New York, the old Dutch North Church had fallen on sad days. People had moved away, businesses had cropped up, and other churches were closing down. There was a floating population. The church congregation had dwindled. In a last-ditch stand, they decided to appoint a lay missionary to conduct a visitation program. Got a picture of him here, this man. He's called Jeremiah Lamphere. You got a picture? You want me to do it? There we go. There he is. There's his statue in New York. And he was a merchant. He didn't have any experience about Christian ministry or anything. He was 49 years old. And he was given the job to go around and knocking on people's doors and encouraging them, inviting them to come along to the church, consider the gospel. He took a salary of less than $1,000 a year. He worked with very little success, but he had a burden. That's the point. He had a burden. He was prompted to hold a prayer meeting from 12 till 1. Through the week, and he advertised it, and that's the advertisement there, just encouraging people to come and to pray. At first, the very first meeting, 6 people turned up. They agreed to meet again next week. In 3 weeks later, there was a financial crash. Sounds familiar? The financial crash, and there was panic. But a movement began from that small burden, that small beginning. A movement began that spread right across America and came across the Atlantic to here as well. The 1859 revival started with that burden with one man. Now, what about you? What about you this morning? Nehemiah is not a prophet. He's not a priest. He's not a religious clergyman. If anything, he's more like a civil servant, isn't he? He's working for the king of Persia. Could God give you a burden for his glory? Give you a burden for his church? A burden for the name of Jesus Christ, for his glory in this area. It's like Paul, isn't it, when he went to Athens, looking around and seeing all the idols in Athens. He was greatly distressed because he cared about the glory of Christ. When God starts a movement, when he starts doing a new thing, he gives his people a burden. Not a sentimental burden, just for the church or the good old days. Not that. But a burden for Christ's glory, for God's glory. And he can do it again. We want to see Jesus lifted high. He used to sing this as a student. We want to see Jesus lifted high. A banner that flies across this land, that all men might see the truth and know he is the way to heaven. So, a burden. We learn that from this chapter. Then I want you to notice a confession. A confession. Can I do this? Or somebody else? There we go. Here we have Nehemiah's prayer recorded for us. Why is it there? Well, it must be there for us. It must be there for us to learn something from it. I think you learn a lot about a person when you hear them pray, don't you? You learn a lot about their relationship with God when you pray with them. You hear them talking to God themselves. Well, we're listening in on Nehemiah. Look at his wonder, first of all. Look at his wonder. Sense of wonder as he comes to God. Look how he addresses God. Lord, the God of heaven, the great and awesome God. The great and awesome God who keeps his covenant of love with those who love him and keep his commandments. He acknowledges that God is worthy of honour and praise. I was on a church website the other day, a church I didn't know. I was looking for something else. And I went onto the website and the message was, everyone is awesome. Everyone is awesome. Well, Nehemiah obviously didn't get that message because he recognizes the unique awesomeness of God. And he's filled with wonder and worship. And he mentions specifically God's faithfulness to his covenant. He's a God who keeps his promises. And Nehemiah is filled with wonder. Lord, the God of heaven, the great and awesome God. And then listen to his words of confession. We have acted very wickedly towards you, verse 7. We've acted very wickedly towards you. Now he could have said, couldn't he? They have acted very wickedly towards you. They, the people in the past, the people who worshipped idols and resulted in the exile. They have acted wickedly. But he doesn't say that, does he? He says, we have acted wickedly, including myself and my father's family. Verse 6. The reason the exile took place was because of their unfaithfulness. They turned away from the Lord. They worshipped other gods. And Nehemiah includes himself in that. I think that's really important, isn't it? For two reasons. There are two dangers that we've got to avoid. One is self-pity. Self-pity. Oh, this is terrible. Oh, we're all victims. Oh, God's let us down. Very easy to fall into that kind of thinking and mentality. Or the other way, the other fault is self-righteousness. It's all their fault. It's their fault. It's not my fault. You see how Nehemiah avoids those two things? As he confesses to God? If he's self-righteous, he could have seen himself as this I'm the Lone Ranger. I'm going to come in. I'm going to sort them all out. I'm going to save them. Flying in like Spider-Man. That's a danger too. Nehemiah avoids that with this confession. We have sinned. I have sinned. We are in this state because of our bad behavior. And we need to confess our sin. I'm reminded of the story from Scotland in the church service. I think it was a communion service in Scotland. And the minister was at the front and he was watching, and the bread and the wine were being passed around. And there was a woman there who was really under conviction. And she was not going to take the bread and the wine that day. And the pastor knew her situation. He knew that she was a genuine believer. But she was so overwhelmed that she wasn't going to take the bread and the wine. And he got down and he sat next to her and he said, "Take it. It's for sinners like us. It's for sinners like us." That's Nehemiah's position. We need God's grace, don't we? All of us. It's for sinners like us. So rebuilding, when God rebuilds our spiritual lives, it can begin with a fresh view of God. The great and awesome God. Seeing him again in his glory. Behold our God, seated on his throne. Come, let us adore him. That's what it's about. Rebuilding spiritual lives can also begin with confession. Honest self-examination. No cover-ups and no excuses. Where is the Lord in our hearts? Have other things taken his place? Have we been unfaithful to him? Listen to David in Psalm 32. When I kept silent, my bones wasted away through my groaning all day long. For day and night your hand was heavy on me. My strength was sapped as in the heat of summer. Then I acknowledged my sin to you and did not cover up my iniquity. I said, I will confess my transgression to the Lord, and you forgave the guilt of my sin. That was a turning point in David's life. You forgave the guilt of my sin. And it opened up fresh relationships with the Lord. It opened up renewed joy. David was rebuilt after that experience. Honest confession to God opens up the door of forgiveness and renewed closeness with him. So you've got this burden, you've got this confession, and then you've got a petition. A petition. Verses 8 to 11. We're used to signing petitions, aren't we, today? Sign this petition online or somewhere in the street, sign this petition. Well, in chapter 2, Nehemiah will petition the king of Persia, Artaxerxes, this most powerful man in the world, on the planet at this time. But here, before he does that, he petitions God, he petitions the Lord. And there's two aspects to his petition. One is a global petition. This is a big prayer. Look what he says. Remember the instruction you gave your servant Moses, saying, if you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the nations. But if you return to me and obey my commands, then even if your exiled people are at the farthest horizon, that's a big prayer, If they're at the farthest horizon, I will gather them from there and bring them to the place I have chosen as a dwelling for my name. Nehemiah is praying according to that promise. Lord, it's a big, bold prayer that God would gather his people from the farthest horizon. How could he be so brave to pray a prayer like that? Where does he get the kind of audacity to pray like that? Well, because he believes God. That's why. He believes God's word. You have promised, Lord, he says. You've promised this. And the Lord is faithful to his covenant. That's why he prays. Great prayers grow from the soil of God's great promises. I'm sure every parent has fallen foul of this. They've made promises and their children come to them and say, Dad, you promised. You promised the McDonald's. You promised to take us to the zoo. You promised. And all parents have to hang their head in shame. But God likes to be reminded of his promises. We see that time and again in the Bible. God likes to be reminded. He likes it when we come and say, Lord, you've promised. Please do it. And that's what Nehemiah is doing here. You've promised, Lord, to build your church. You've promised. Gates of hell will not prevail. You've promised. You've promised, Lord, to grow your kingdom. Didn't you tell the parable of the mustard seed and that it would grow and grow and grow? Lord, you promised in that parable. Do it, Lord. It's kind of global praying. But then there's personal prayer as well. Look at verse 11. Give your servant success today by granting him favour in the presence of this man. That's good, isn't it? I love that. He's only this man. He's the king of the Persian Empire. He's Artaxerxes. But he's this man. How can Nehemiah make such a request? Grant me favour. Well, because he knows God's character. He knows that God is a God who delights to show favour. In the time of my favour, I will answer you, Isaiah says, or God says through Isaiah. He delights to show favour. So he prays a personal request with confidence. Give me favour, Lord. I'm going to ask the king. I'm going into the presence of this man, but show me favour. Now, there are times out there in our Christian lives when we don't have maybe a specific promise from God that we can say, Lord, you've promised. But we can come to him and we can pray because he's a God who delights to show favour. He's a God of grace. And that encourages you this week to come to pray to him. It may not be a specific promise, but he knows your needs. And he's the God of all grace. I recall the story of a little boy in South Wales, the South Wales Valleys. It was at the time when the mines were flourishing. And the little boy wanted to go down and see his dad coming up from the pit. When the hooter went, the end of the shift. They're all coming up from the shift. And somebody said, well, Johnny, why are you going down there? You won't recognize him. They all look the same. And he says, ah, but he'll recognize me. He'll recognize me. He had confidence in his father's character. And that's what it is for us. We can come to God boldly and confidently and bring our cares to him. Because he's a God who delights to show favor. It's a wonderful thing about being a Christian. We're adopted into God's family. We're called the children of God. He recognizes you. He knows you. We were at an adoption ceremony on Friday. There's a couple in our church who've adopted a little girl. We went to Chester and it was all formalized. It was wonderful. And I was thinking, isn't that great? How great the love that God has lavished upon us, that we should be called the children of God. And that is what we are. Now, if Nehemiah then can have confidence, back there in the Old Testament, Lord, grant me favour, how much more can we? Grant us favour, Lord. If God is for us, who can be against us? He who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us, how will he not also, along with him, graciously give us all things? William Carey said, expect great things from God, attempt great things for God, but before that we can ask great things of God. We can do that as a church. So there's a petition. There's a burden here, there's a confession here. There's this great petition that tells us so much about God and how we can approach him. But then lastly, there's a vision. This is just how I want to conclude this morning. There's a vision. A vision of the greatest servant leader. A vision of the greatest builder. Nehemiah's name means Yahweh has comforted. The Lord has comforted his people. That's what Nehemiah means. And through him, Nehemiah is going to be a comfort. God is going to call him to serve. And I'm sure you know the story. He ends up going to Jerusalem and rebuilding the walls and rebuilding the people. He is a comfort. God comforts his people through Nehemiah. And yet he calls himself a servant. I am your servant. Does that remind you of anybody? Anybody who left a gloriously high position, who left it willingly and came to be a servant, to restore his people, to redeem his people. Of course, Nehemiah ultimately points us to Christ, to Jesus. That's how we should read the Old Testament, isn't it? We should always be looking for him. Nehemiah points us to Jesus, the builder of an eternal city, a city of the living God. Jesus responds to the call of his Father. He has a burden, doesn't he? Father, glorify your name. I've come not to do my will, but your will. Your will be done. And he's humble. He humbles himself. He was equal with God, yet he made himself nothing, taking on the form of a servant, becoming human. He humbles himself. He identifies with sinners in his baptism and at the cross. In his ministry, he identifies with sinners. He suffers for our transgression. He prays for his people that they would be one, that they will see his glory. He prays for them. And he promises, I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. Jesus Christ is the great restorer of our lives. The great restorer of this world. And ultimately the great restorer of this universe. When he comes again in all his glory. To make a new heavens and a new earth. He is our great Nehemiah. And we should look to him. The one who trusts in him will never be put to shame. God promises. So let Nehemiah point you to Jesus. Amen.